Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here again today for another episode. This is number 413, and in a few moments, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with Dr. Drew Remignanti. Dr. Remignanti is an emergency room physician who has written a book called The Healing Connection, and he has a whole section of his book on end-of-life decision-making and talks about his experiences in the emergency room and around death and dying, but also his personal journey as a patient who's been dealing with the medical system since he was 19 years old. So Dr. Remignanti has a lot of really interesting information to share with us, and I think you'll enjoy that conversation. Before we get to that, a couple of announcements. I wanted to let you know that the Institute for the Study of Birth, Breath, and Death has an upcoming consultant training on holding space. You can become a holding space consultant. The training will take place in the fall online. And right now, they're offering an early bird special. You can sign up for that training at a 90% discount. It will only cost $35 if you sign up now, and you have until the end of July 2023. So that's just 1 week from today if you decide you'd like to do it. But I highly recommend it. And as you hear in this conversation with Dr. Remignanti, being able to be present and hold space for people is one of the most important things that we can do. It's one of the most important aspects of the healing relationship. So I think this training sounds fantastic, and to be able to get it for such an amazing discount would be highly worthwhile. I will leave a link in the show notes to the page where you can go to sign up for that. So come to eolupodcast.com, scroll down to links mentioned in this episode, and there will be a link there for the consultant training. So you can go sign up for that and take advantage of the discount. And then I'll mention once again that the company Anuma, the health startup company, is looking for individuals to participate in a study involving a unique healing and connectivity program using virtual reality called Clear Light. The program is designed for individuals working with a life-threatening disease diagnosis. These exclusive sessions are currently being offered free of charge. This is a really great benefit to take advantage of. As part of a trial supported by researchers at Imperial College London. And if you'd like more details or wish to indicate interest in participating, you can go to this link, anuma.com/trial. And I got a chance to experience part of the Clear Light program last fall. I wrote a blog about it, and I'll leave a link for the blog for my previous interview with Gregory Rufa and Lama Karma from Anuma that you can listen to, and also the link to sign up for that trial if you're interested. So these are some really fantastic benefits available to you out there at free or very low cost. So I hope you'll take advantage of those. And finally, I'd like to thank my newest supporter on my Patreon page, Carol Heaney. Thank you so much, Carol, for signing up to be a member of our team at patreon.com/EOLU. And Carol will now receive access to the monthly end-of-life news update, which I create and curate every month for people who are my patrons at patreon.com/EOLU. Thanks to everyone who signed up there. Also, all of you who've been buying me coffees and making contributions through PayPal. I really appreciate it. So now we'll move on with my interview with Dr. Drew Remignanti. As always, I'll come back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Dr. Drew Remignanti. Dr. Remignanti is an emergency medicine physician who has lived himself with chronic illness since being diagnosed with ulcerative colitis at age 19. After suffering a major stroke in 1992, which sidetracked his career for 5 years, he earned a master's degree in public health and then eventually returned to full-time emergency medical practice. This journey inspired him to write the book, The Healing Connection, A Partnership for Your Health, which we'll be discussing today. The book explores how dollar-driven decisions wield too much influence over our medical decisions as patients and sadly as physicians and as well, including at the end of life. And you can learn more about the book and when it's published and available on Dr. Remignanti's Facebook page under his name, Drew Remignanti. And I will have that all spelled out in the show notes so that you won't have to figure out how to spell it. But Dr. Remignanti, Drew, I hope I can call you.
Drew is fine, preferable.
Welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Karen.
I wanted to start our discussion, and I'll mention that your book, The Healing Connection, is an amazing resource, and it is packed with references. You had to do so much reading and studying to write this book because it has so many references in it, 270 references, and it's a really wonderful depiction of really our current medical system and a lot of the things that are going wrong and some of your ideas for how things could go better. And we won't be talking about much of that, but I highly recommend that people read the entire book to get the full picture of our medical system right now and issues that are going on. Because today, for my audience, we're going to focus in more on issues around the end of life. But I just wanted to give that plug for your book and hope that people will buy it and read it. And it's coming out in July, hopefully
before mid-July.
Yeah, so it's a brand new book, hot off the presses, that people can get their hands on and really learn, you know, from an emergency room physician's perspective, some of the serious issues that are going on in medicine. And I wanted to start by talking with you as an emergency room physician about what happens when people die in the emergency room, because I know that you've spent a lot of your time with these kind of scenarios when people come to the ER without an advance directive. And maybe you could take us through some typical scenarios of what that's like. And it's heartbreaking and tragic from our perspective, but I think it's good for everyone to be aware of why they need to have an advance directive that's accessible and available.
Yeah, I think that's critical. I'm sure that I'm at risk as much as anybody being a stubborn individual for not being willing to anticipate the end of my life and being, but I'm trying to avoid that. What we typically see in the emergency department is patients come in without an advance directive. And if they're really badly off, they will have already been intubated by the ambulance personnel before they see me or immediately by me. And family often says something like, he wouldn't want to be kept alive on a machine like a vegetable, which is an admirable idea. But if you haven't expressed that openly and actually gotten it documented in a legal fashion, EMS personnel will ignore most of what you say and will just do it because emergency medicine is a full court press attempt on everything. And that's often the correct thing because we don't know what people's past medical history is and do they have a limited prognosis or not. So we're going to do everything for everybody. We'd rather err on the side of doing too much than too little. So that's one side we see, which is people say, you know, he wouldn't want to live on a machine as a vegetable, but that's not helpful. You need to think about that and have that discussion with your family member well in advance of the ambulance needing to be called. And then the alternative thing we hear from people is, oh, he would want everything done. And then you go on to discover that the person has advanced metastatic cancer. And you say, really, you really think he would want everything done? So one of the things you can do is with loved ones, have that conversation, better yet, in the presence of that person's physician, because the physician can guide you in terms of what questions need to be asked and answered so that you can delineate your desires.
And I know, I mean, still in our society, the statistics I read are that maybe 35% of people even have completed an advance directive, have even thought about what they might want if they were in this kind of emergency situation. And yet, I would think far fewer people actually have that advance directive with them when they're when the EMTs arrive and when they're in an ambulance. Like, so the they may have completed one, but no one knows where it is or it's exactly not available.
One of the tricks the EMS people say is they tell people to put it in your freezer because that's one of the first places they're going to look. You know, put it in a plastic bag in your freezer, and because that's where they or look for it on the surface of the refrigerator in your freezer, so it's readily accessible.
Yeah, because even people who've taken the time to complete an advance directive may not have their wishes honored because it just isn't available in the moment. And I'm sure there are lots of stories about people collapsing on the street or being in an accident when they're not at home where their advance directive is. So it seems to me like this is, it's a really big problem and we haven't found a way to get around this yet.
No, there's no, it's, and again, I acknowledge that it's a difficult thing to conceive of your own demise, you know, but we're going to do everything. And if you certainly it's easier for not maybe not easier, but more and more accessible idea to people who've received a poor prognosis from a bad diagnosis, like you have an advanced cancer. And I think those people have the fortunate situation aspect of their situation where their doctor will bring it up. But if you don't have something like that, then it's sort of on your shoulders to bring it up with your physician and a hard conversation to broach. And
so I'm curious if a patient has had a discussion with their family, as you say, you hear sometimes from the family, but is that not enough for you to be able to go on if they can't produce the record or if they don't know where it is or don't even know if that there is a legal record?
Well, different emergency physicians make different calls on that. If I have, and it's tenuous situation because if your relative is trying to off you and says, you know, best poisoned you and you come in and they say, well, let him go. He wanted, you know, so there's that. So you have to make an assessment based on all the people you've seen over the years. Does this person seem like a reliable one? How much do they know about this person? You know, I usually respect the wishes of the family member who's there, who's gives me the gestalt of being a reliable person. I had a colleague once who says he ignores everything they say. If they can't produce a paper, he'll intubate people. And that's, you know, that seemed to me more self-protective than considerate. And I've been willing to go out on a limb during my career and follow some people who seem like caring family members. But it's risky for me to say, well, how do I know this person doesn't have that person's best interest in mind?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, any of the steps we take, like even intubating a person, the tube can be removed if the decision is made that that wasn't the right step, it can be removed. But if the person is never intubated and they die because of that, we can't reverse that decision. So it makes sense why the default is that we have to do as much as is possible to do unless there's very clear direction not to do that.
Yeah, I would make the additional comment that if you have a loved one who's in some kind of a care facility, a nursing home or assisted living facility, that you should revisit that their end of life wishes probably monthly at minimum to make sure that if there's staff turnover, you'd say, you know, I'd say, can you locate my father or mother's end of life paperwork to make sure it hasn't been misplaced or lost? And I'd look at it and review it. Does that reflect what the last conversation you had with that patient is? Because it's not unusual for us to get somebody come in by ambulance from the nursing home and they don't even have the paperwork with them for a number of reasons I address in my book. They're getting pressured to be productive and cut corners to save money for the private equity people who have bought their nursing home. So I'm not saying that they're untrustworthy, but to get a reminder from you as a caring family member, it's very clear that my mother, you know, she doesn't want to be intubated under any circumstances. That's easy if you, there are other circumstances, like with the recent COVID epidemic, people were being intubated and kept on ventilators for sometimes weeks and then coming off the ventilator as they recovered from their COVID. So it can be a, you know, difficult call to make, but it doesn't benefit from no conversation. It benefits from multiple conversations.
Absolutely. And would it work if family members had a copy of their loved one's advance directive with them so that they themselves could bring it into the ER when they come in?
Yes, I would think that'd be a great idea, as long as it's signed and witnessed. And something that's dated, signed, and witnessed, I would respect that.
Yeah. And I think I always like to tell people, sometimes people have the impression that doctors don't care that much and are just kind of cold and callous and don't really care what a person's wishes are. But I try to explain to people, we have these default processes in medicine because you can't make judgments just by looking from the outside until you have more evidence or until you can do more studies to find out exactly what's going on. You don't know for sure. What's happening might be reversible and you just don't know. And so that's why the default is do everything until you do know what's happening.
That's exactly right. And some people are under the impression, if they've gone through this process with family members, that that document will be at the nursing home and at the hospital also. And it may be true that they are in both places, but if I don't have it front and center, so your suggestion of family members actually even having a copy on their person in case of sudden emergencies, that's a good strategy.
Yeah, I'm curious because it seems to me when we first started learning about electronic medical records that one of the hopes was, everyone's advance directive would be in the system, in the electronic medical record, and you'd be able to see it immediately when someone came in.
Yeah, ideally everything would be everywhere, but very often, if most of your records, I happen to work at several times in situations where there was a neighboring hospital in the same town and people would unfortunately ping pong back from one to the other and say, all her records are here, when they got confused and all her records were actually over at the other hospital in town. And many hospitals have different EHRs that don't share records. And at that point, as an emergency doctor, I can't be taking time to make that decision about intubation. If I think it's necessary, it's an instantaneous act. It's not something you can wait hours to.
Exactly. I mean, and that's your job, to act in the moment right now based on what you know. But you write about slow medicine, which is upstream slow medicine. I don't know, maybe slow medicine can happen in the ER, but the slow medicine concept is more about the kinds of care people receive before they end up in the emergency room. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that, because I see that as a movement I'm hearing more and more about these days.
Yes, I think it's an important one. It's not as relevant to emergency medicine as you say, but there are certain decisions we make. They're not end-of-life issues, questions, is it advisable to get a CAT scan on a child who fell and hit their head? Now, that can be a slow, lengthy conversation. Is it advisable to be admitted to the hospital with a condition that you might be adequately treated for at home if you're an older person with a risk for contracting a hospital-acquired infection? But all the forces in healthcare nowadays are working against the idea of slow medicine, because it doesn't take a brilliant business person to think the more people you can move through the system, the more charges you can generate and the more money you can make. And that's, I think it's going to take a partnership between us as patients and us as physicians saying, we have to stop this nonsense. We have to slow things down and make deliberate decisions for the best welfare of patients.
Yeah, exactly. And as you said, the system itself and the forces within the system are pushing everything to speed up too much. So decreasing the amount of time that physicians and patients spend together in the office, like that time has gotten shorter and shorter because there's such an emphasis on seeing more patients in less time. Also on just completing electronic health records, because that's taking up a huge amount of time for doctors too, which takes them away from time with patients.
And time with patients should be something that they measure or they value. But again, if you're a business person, you don't value that because it's not your expertise. We value it as physicians. And if we make too much noise as physicians saying we need more time with patients, people have actually been fired for publicly complaining about pressures being brought on to bear on them to be productive that's not in the patient's best interest.
And this is talking about physicians who are being employed by another entity, because these days it seems a lot more rare that there are doctors just in private practice who are doing their own business within their own small little office or clinic, and which is how it was when I first started practicing medicine. But that's been a huge shift in medicine now that more doctors are employed, I think, than self-employed.
Yes, definitely. The self-employed doctors are in the minority at this point, or certainly less than half.
Yeah. But even as a self-employed doctor, there's kind of a lack of control when you're dealing with insurance companies and their expectations and electronic health records. You still have to go through a lot of the same processes, whether you're employed by someone else or not.
That's true. The pre-authorizations for being able to order the tests that you think your patient needs and the medication that your patients need.
One of the things that you emphasize in the book is the healing connection and the fact that the relationship between a physician and a patient has a healing power. It's very important. And it's that very relationship in a way that's being threatened by some of these changes in our system right now.
Yes, it's a transformation that's going on. It's really more of a process of corruption where the patient-physician relationship is being changed into the consumer-provider relationship. That you were viewed as consumers, as patients. How can we generate money for the business? And they're trying to create a false equivalence between physicians and mid-level providers and even alternative medicine providers. It's you want a skilled, scientifically trained physician. And if you want to do additional alternative medicine stuff or see mid-level providers in addition to that, that's okay. But for the business people, they want the person they can pay the least amount of money to take care of us as patients, not the person who's best for us as patients.
And I'm interested because I'm trained as a primary care physician. And so I've been aware of the importance of that physician-patient relationship and having a long-term relationship and getting to know patients well. So I was curious about in the emergency room, you don't really have opportunities, I would think, for those types of relationships, but you are very well aware of the benefits and the power. Is that because of your own experience as a patient?
I think it's partly that I made a great, after my stroke, I was only 38 when I had my stroke. And at that point, I didn't even have a primary care doctor because I didn't see the value in it. I was a little short-sighted. I was young and relatively young and very healthy and thought, when you're that, you're in denial about what can happen to you. And so then I picked up a primary care doctor when I got admitted to the hospital. And of course, a neurologist consulted on me and she sort of acted as my primary care doctor because my only health problem was my stroke. And I think she, the fact that we connected very personally and she had to give me the guidance ultimately is, was I able to rehabilitate, to return to the practice of emergency medicine, which was important to me. And, she had to strike a balance to be realistic with me and not, not falsely encourage me, but not discourage me either. And she perfectly threaded the needle, I think. And that was because we spent enough time, talking to each other and she, perceived what would be best for me. So it doesn't have to be, if you have a single problem, like a cardiac problem or a neurological problem, your specialist could act in that role, but better off to have a primary care doctor there.
Does it seem to you that fewer and fewer people actually have their own primary care doctor that they see for most of their healthcare problems?
Absolutely. In fact, in my book, I quote this, it's gotten so bad that people are willing to say almost anything out loud now. This woman who is the CEO of a $1.5 billion healthcare system that I quoted in my book was asked in an interview by a medical business publication, what does she see as one concept that needs to be challenged in healthcare? And the concept she thought needed to be challenged was that patients need a primary care physician. Her comment was they need primary care, but not necessarily a physician relationship. I was stunned and insulted and surprised and at the same time thrilled that she said it out loud because hospital administrators typically say, all we care about is the welfare of the community. And so she made it clear that that's not all they care about. And so that's what we're up against as patients and as physicians, that people who are making the prime movers in healthcare nowadays are the people at the administrative levels of hospital systems, health insurance systems, and pharmaceutical companies. And politicians have more input than we do as physicians or we do as patients. So So as patients and physicians, we have an incentive to change the system, but we don't have the power to do it. Politicians and the people at the administrative levels of those institutions have the power, but no incentive, because they're making pretty good money and or they're keeping their elected positions. So we need to rock the boat, and we need to rock the boat as a team, as a partnership, patient and physician together.
And from the end of life perspective, I think more people would have advanced directives that are completed or would have had a conversation around end of life issues if they had a primary care doctor that they trusted, who's been providing care for them over the long term, who really understood their health situation very well. They would be much more likely to be advised by that doctor, you know, let's think about the future, let's do some planning ahead. And, but nowadays, even I do hear even from friends of mine and people I know, they never see the same doctor twice. Sometimes even for the same condition, they go to a clinic and they end up with different people every time. And there's no continuity with any one physician.
I quoted, as you pointed out, I quote 250 plus references that make all of these points that we're talking about. So there's not just opinion on your side or opinion on my side. There's good scientific evidence for it, that when people trust their physicians and they know and trust their physicians, and additionally, they feel known by their physicians, they are far more likely to participate in the development of a care plan for any condition, and of course also for end of life planning would be part of that, and they're far more likely to participate in that and then follow that plan than if they are bouncing around from one provider to another. But the system doesn't, you know, the dollar driven decision making doesn't care who the patient is in front of, as long as they're in and out quickly and a bill can be generated.
Yeah. And you quoted in your book from another book that I love, which is Compassionomics. And they've done extensive studies to show what a difference compassion makes in the care of a patient when that compassion comes from healthcare providers at any level. But it's harder to show compassion for someone you've never met before and you know nothing about than someone you've developed a relationship with. And so I don't know if there's anything from that book that you wanted to mention here around compassion.
Yeah, it was interesting because I do have I refer to that book quite a bit. In fact, when I read that book, I was almost disappointed because I thought, boy, those guys are saying a lot of what I want to say. And I thought, well, their book's going to have a big impact. I was disappointed it didn't have more impact. And I wrote my book anyway because I had some additional things I wanted to say, but that's a great reference for people to read. But the two articles that studies they did quote, one is showing that a scripted 40-second conversation that a healthcare provider has with a patient can have a very positive effect on their anxiety and their outcomes. And it takes a mere 40 seconds, they showed. And at the same time, doctors early in their training don't feel like they have the time to show compassion. And that's, again, because they're trying to meet too many masters. They're trying to do right by their patient, but they're being told they have to do this faster. They have to do this in addition. They have to master the electronic health record and dot all the T's, then cross all the T's, dot all the I's.
That's so true. And I love the study that said it only takes 40 seconds. A 40-second interaction of compassion had significant benefits for a patient. So, which would mean, I think, even in the emergency room, when you're in a crisis situation, you can show compassion that could help a patient with pain and anxiety or whatever they're experiencing. And is that something that you
I think we try to make those connections, even though we know we're meeting people for the first time, you know, almost constantly. Occasionally I'll see the same person a second time or even a third time, but almost always it's a fresh thing. And I try to, you know, acknowledge as much as I can, depending on what I have to do for them or to them, you know, that I acknowledge what I can understand about what they're suffering and show some compassion for what they're going through.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it's such a great argument that 40 seconds of time made a difference. How can we not find 40 seconds somewhere in our interactions?
Yeah, then they have the Good Samaritan study. I don't know if you recall that from my book. So they take these seminarian students who are obviously committed to a career of compassion because they're going into And so then they put him in this conflictual situation where they say, you need to get to this place at a certain time in order to give a presentation on the Good Samaritan of all things. And then there's the study designers have a Confederate who they make lay on the ground along the path that person has to travel and be in obvious physical distress. But then when the patient, when the seminarian student gets there, they have to say, no, I don't need your help. So they have to present them that conflict, which is they need to get somewhere to help somebody else. This person obviously needs help, but he's saying he doesn't need help, even though to your, you know, to your eyes, it's clear he needs help. And the students felt so conflicted that very many of them never really even stopped to help. They just went to meet the other need. So that's the position we're in as healthcare people. We're trying to meet the demands of this taskmaster, our administrative folks, and yet we're having to deal with patients visibly suffering right in front of us, patient after patient after patient, and we're not given the tools or the time to meet that patient's needs. And we might, that's what leads to the concept of moral injury and burnout, because you think, in order to live with what I'm doing now, I have to keep that at arm's length. I have to keep that so far away from me that I can't really get in at my soul and heart, you know. And one of the ways you do that is by being abrupt and saying, okay, he said, no, I'm going, I'm out of here.
Yeah, and the conflict is there's no priority. The patients have not been made a priority in giving care to the patients in front of us. And as you said, so our obligations are wide and to other entities, to the CEO of the company that owns our clinic or that owns the emergency room, and the administrators who want us to complete our paperwork and do our charging for the insurance company. And then the insurance company too, we have to document for them and we have to justify tests we want to order. That it's confusing because there's so many masters to serve. Exactly. And when it should be that the priority is just the patient, what does the patient need in front of you and how do you provide that care?
Yeah. And I don't think the dilemma we're in the United States is not an us versus them. I mean, it feels a little bit like us versus them. And I say that in my book a little bit. The us is us as physicians and us as patients, our colleagues in this, our partners in this. And the other side of the them is the people who are actually in charge of making decisions, the politicians and the administrative people. But I think they are only able to make the decisions they make because they keep the suffering of patients at such an arm's length that they if you're not experiencing it or seeing it, you can make your pure business decision because business ethics say you have to do what's best for the organization. But we need to somehow reverse that priority in healthcare in the U.S. We have to say the needs of the patients come first, business interests come second. It's going to take a whole reimagining of what's being a success in the business world. But I don't think it's unimaginable or unachievable for us to do that in the U.S., but it's going to take an all hands on deck effort to do that.
Yeah. So healthcare providers are just getting stretched thin in some ways by these competing interests pulling at them, and their heart may say to them, I only want to focus on this patient and what they need. And yet they're to keep their job, they may have to attend to the other demands that are on their time.
Yeah, if I was, I very often joked during my career that if you gave me all the power and all the money in the world, I couldn't change the course of U.S. healthcare, because it's really going to take. I think it's going to take a 2x2 force where patients and their primary care doctors form a partnership, an equal partnership with different expertises. Have the medical expertise. You as the patient have the expertise in knowing how you feel and what you want to accomplish with your healthcare. And then together we have to tell the system what we're willing to put up with and what we're not. And one dyad is not going to do that, but innumerable dyads can potentially, try to get the ship of healthcare back on course.
Do you think we need changes in medical education as well? Do you think there's a problem with how students are being educated?
It's been so long, I hesitate to say. I think probably not, because I've met hundreds, I'm sure at this point, thousands of doctors, both young and old, during my career. I haven't met a single doctor who I didn't think that their number one priority was getting it right in regards to patients. I've met a number and myself at times where I found myself making a decision that I regretted because at that moment, I had another motivation in mind. I want to satisfy my department director. I want to satisfy somebody else. But, you know, I think even the, you know, I think all doctors learn during the course of the medical training that getting it right for the benefit of the patient is priority number one, but then you're thrown into the soup where you got all these other competing demands. And so I don't think you can educate people out of that. You have to change the system that they graduate into.
Yeah. Well, I would say that one thing, you know, from my hospice training that I feel concerned about is that medical students don't get trained very well in end of life issues. So they don't get much training, at least I didn't, in death and dying or how to have conversations about end of life issues with patients. And I remember even being told as a medical student, we had a patient on our service that got transferred off and they said, oh, well, that person's terminal now, so they're not a good teaching case. So we're transferring them off and we'll bring a different patient on that you can learn something from. It now I look back at that and think, oh my gosh, we all needed to learn from this patient who was dying on our service by experiencing that, not having them sent away somewhere and none of us knew when they died or what took place there.
Yeah, I have some portion of one chapter of my book about end-of-life issues and the concept of spirituality, and we use it both religious-based and non-religion-based spirituality in terms of the decisions it helps you to make at the end of life. And they teach that now in medical schools. We never got any of that in 1980-83 when I was in medical school. I'm sorry, 76 to 80 was when I was in medical school. We never talked about spirituality in healthcare, but now it's a topic that's being taught at most medical schools now. So I think things are getting a little bit better there.
Yeah, that's good to see. And it reinforces, well, I almost feel worried though for new doctors who are still coming out with even more kind of like heart-based tendencies toward medicine, yet they're still part of this cold system that's going to really put them through the ringer and stretch them apart as they try to keep caring for patients, but have these other demands on them. And you write about, I guess what we're talking about, you write about the commoditization of medicine. I just wanted to have you kind of define that term and what you mean by that, because I think that's kind of the heart of this problem.
Yeah. Well, the reference I have in my book is in the last quarter of 2017, it was that the healthcare industry was the greatest employer of people in the United States, surpassing retail and manufacturing for the first time. So there's a huge number of people involved, you know, employed by the current healthcare system we have in the U.S. So you have to generate money to pay all those people. And it's been seen as a commodity similar to retail. You know, if you're, you know, selling shirts, selling cars, you know, you're selling consumer good. We're selling or they're selling is patient care interactions. And it's not a consumable product, you know, and yet it's an easy way to make money. You can make bucket loads of money in America and deliver mediocre medical care because most people are not aware when they're getting mediocre medical care.
It's a good point. You know, when we apply these business principles, which probably are good ideas for running a business, they don't really work in medicine because, you know, if you have a fast food chain, you benefit from making sure every restaurant knows how to make a hamburger exactly the same way and put it together the same way because customers expect that and they want consistency. They want it to be the same. So standardization is a good thing in that kind of scenario, but that doesn't work in medicine at all because every single one of your patients is different, has a different set of issues going on. Even if you line up 10 people with the same diagnosis, it's different in every single patient.
So exactly
we cannot standardize that type of care. You have to get to know each one of those patients and understand everything else happening for them.
If you and I both are having heart attacks, your heart attack may manifest in a different way. And then also your course of your recovery from that will depend on what your intrinsic strengths are and what other resources you have in your life in terms of supportive family, et cetera. And it's different for every person. And one of the other things I touch on is the degree of optimism you have about your ability to recover from whatever health challenges life is giving you. I mean, you can't wish yourself well. So I'm not trying to be Pollyannish about it, but the studies I quote show that people who have positive expectations about the course of their health sometimes will do better than people who have. So their subjective health evaluation is very often associated with, if it's positive, your subjective health evaluation, you have a lower mortality rate than people with better objective health status, but worse subjective health status. So the mind is a powerful thing in that regard.
Yeah. So people who answer a survey and say, I'm in good health or I'm in great health, regardless of what's actually happening inside their bodies, do better than people who see themselves as being in poor health and who think of themselves as being unhealthy.
Yeah, precisely. And again, not to be Pollyannish about it, that's not sufficient for your medical care to wish yourself well or to just expect to always be well. And it can undermine you at the end of life if you have unrealistic expectations about your ability to recover from a terminal disease or life-threatening disease.
But that kind of brings me back to the patient-physician relationship too, that it seems like you might be more likely to feel optimistic if you have a good, solid relationship in a provider that you trust, that you believe is going to help you with what you need, someone you can go to and talk to, that you may feel more optimistic and more positive about your health because you're connected in such a positive way to a provider.
No doubt about it. I mean, yeah. it'd be different if you were just saying that because it sounds nice to say, but the studies support it, not just like a single study here or there, study after study after study support what you just said.
Yeah. And which again is one of the, it's one of the beauties of your book is that there's nothing in your book that hasn't been supported by studies and usually copious studies because you've done such a good job of documenting and referencing everyone. And so, as you said, it's far from being Pollyannish. It's very scientifically based, every single thing that you write about in the book. So something that has been demonstrated more than one time to be of value with patients. But I'm wondering, where should people start? Like, where should the public start? Those of us who are out here wondering, what do I do? I don't have a primary care doctor. Like, what suggestions do you have? Where can we begin?
It is a difficult one. I would start with asking family and friends who their primary care doctor is and how satisfied they are with them. You can call the hospital in your, I'd choose which hospital in your geographic area you would want to be admitted to the hospital if you had to be. I live in an area where there's three hospitals almost equidistant from where I live. I favor the hospital that I used to work at. And so I picked a doctor who works out of that hospital after hearing from my neighbor several houses over that they had that same doctor. And I was happy with that. And then, of course, after getting those recommendations, then you have to see the doctor several times and make your own assessment. Is this somebody I feel I can work with? Can we communicate well? Does he or she listen to me when I talk? Does she seem to take in with what I'm saying? And so you have to, it takes effort, and you have to create that relationship. We're past the point where we can rely on the old fashioned paternalistic model where you went to the doctor and you just listened to everything they said and did what they said, or at least pretended that you were going to do what they said. It turns out that very often people don't end up following the advice they got from a doctor. So it's more of an egalitarian partnership where we both care. The business of our partnership is your health, and you have to be as committed to your health as I'm going to be committed to your health. And together, we can work on that and achieve great things based on what the studies show.
Yeah. And well, the two of us talking, like you and I have both retired from medical practice at this point, and there are a lot of physicians in our age group who are going to be retiring in the near future. And I feel a little worried about a healthcare shortage, that there may not be enough doctors. And then that makes me worry for those who are still practicing, that their burdens will grow even greater. And what needs to be done to help our colleagues who are in the middle of all this?
We need to incentivize people going to primary care, young doctors in their training going into primary care. And you can do it in a variety of ways. You can reduce the burden on primary care doctors, the documentation burden. That one of the studies I quote said that if primary care doctor did everything that they were required to do by CMS to adequately document their interactions, it would take them 26.7 hours per day, you know, to meet all those. So, I mean, they're expected to do more work than can be fit into a 24-hour day. And yet they're the least well-paid specialty in medicine, the primary care doctors. So, we could decide that we need to incentivize people going into primary care, is, I think, would be the first place to start. Not that the specialty physician should be paid less. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's a New York Times writer, internal medicine doctor, has had a great book called An American Sickness, I quote her in my book, where the doctors are not where the fat is in the system in terms of where all the money is going. There's up to 30% of medical expenses in the U.S. are considered wasteful expenses because they're either duplicative or they're for low value interventions that patients want, physicians want to give because they make money. And so there's a lot of fat in the system, but it's not what the doctors are being paid. It's understandable that as a patient, you know that healthcare is expensive and you know doctors make a good income. And so you think the one is dependent on the other. Doctors are making too much money and that's why healthcare is so expensive. But Dr. Rosenthal, clearly documents that that's not the issue. And one of the other articles that I quote is a guy, Mark Bertolini, his name was, he was an executive in Aetna, and Aetna was buying CVS or merging with CVS. And, the merger did come off at the time. The article I read, he was expected to make $500 million on the basis of that merger. Now, I'm sure he's a super bright guy, and I'm sure I couldn't pull off that merger, which eventually they did pull off. And I don't know if he made his $500 million, but a lot of the fat in the system is at the administrative level. It's not in the physician level.
Yeah. So very true. So very true. And I do sometimes hear people lumping doctors in when they complain about healthcare. They complain about doctors equally and kind of lump doctors in with our system, that people understand that our system is failing in so many ways. And so I guess you and I are here a little bit to say, take it easy on doctors, because they're far more really good-hearted doctors out there who are caring and doing their very, very best to give care, and who themselves are also victims of the system. They're not the perpetrators.
Yeah, that's definitely it. When I was looking for an agent, when I was initially trying to write my book, and I thought, well, gee, I should get an agent and see if this is a sellable book. And one agent said to me, you know what doctors should do? They should, get together in forums and, consult about what they think is wrong with our healthcare system and initiate changes. And she found the situation very distressing. I had to write back to her, I'm sorry to add to your distress, but doctors are no longer behind the helm of the ship of U.S. healthcare. We haven't been for a while. And we already have forums where specialties, certainly in my emergency medicine specialty, there are a number of forums where we talk about what should be better, should be done differently, can be done differently, would help us, would help patients, would help everybody, but we don't have the power to institute those things.
Yeah, exactly. So hoping for change, but understanding it's going to take a while. And I like your message that patients and doctors need to team up together in order to try to bring change about.
Yeah, I don't think people should feel despondent as patients. I think they should say, I think we have more power as patients than we realize. We can say, you can overnight decide, I'm going to approach my healthcare differently. I'm going to become knowledgeable about my conditions. Next time I'm with my physician, I'm going to say, I realized after reading Drew's book that I need to become a more activated, engaged patient in my own healthcare. Of course, then you have to get out of your own chair and help your doctor up back into his or her chair, because they'll faint at the idea that you want to be more active. And by being more active, you may find a doctor who's not ready for that, and then you might have to change doctors. But these studies show that becoming more informed about and being engaged in planning of and then following through on the plan you come up with your doctor, it can cut your mortality rate in half. So it's not just, we're not, maybe, if you were doing 10 or 15% better than the other folks who didn't do that, it'd be so what, you know. But really, multiple studies I quote show you can cut the mortality rate in half if you're a more engaged patient with your... So that's something as patients we could do overnight. Tomorrow, I'm going to start as a different patient. That's in the context of studies that show that only 12% of U.S. population is considered fully healthcare literate. So an 88% healthcare illiteracy rate in the U.S. And wow. they define healthcare literate as being able to acquire, understand, and apply healthcare knowledge. And many of us are just not capable of doing that. And the majority of us, apparently, according to this study.
Wow, that's kind of shocking. You know.
So it's on us as patients too. We can't just stand by as patients and point at the system and say, it's you. It's all of us. It's us against us, basically.
Yeah. And you yourself, you know what you're talking about because you yourself have been a patient of the healthcare system, having lived with ulcerative colitis for all your life since you were 19, and then having had a stroke, which was certainly a major crisis in your life. So it seems to me that you've gained a lot of wisdom from the patient perspective as well. And is there anything else that you would want to share about that?
I always like to say I feel pretty well educated from both sides of the patient care, both inside it and alongside it. And the book really represents all the conclusions I came to about that. And I think it's a worthwhile read. And I've thrown enough things that I think have some entertainment value in and of themselves in the references. So I think it'll be a good read for people. But I think taking on that responsibility of being an active patient in your own healthcare is key. Asking all the... I define it as a three-step process. You have to find and choose a primary care doctor who you can put your trust in, can fully trust that person. You need to ask all the questions that occur to you when that physician gives you advice, and so that you fully understand it. So you need to be all in on your healthcare plan. And if you're not all in, then you have to stop and say, hey, you know, this idea that I'm going to lose 10 pounds, even though I mentioned that, realistically, I can't see that. Or the idea that you want me to stop smoking, I can't see me doing that. So that's the honest part of it. You have to say what's a realistic plan for you. And then once you come up with that plan in conjunction with your doctor, your commitment has to be, I'm going to do that without fail. Because if you go into the doctor's appointment knowing that you, when you leave the room, whatever you agreed upon, you're committed to. It's kind of like getting married in a sense every time you go in. So you're not going to say I do to somebody who you're having doubts about, or you shouldn't. So you shouldn't leave that interaction with the doctor without having all your questions answered. And yeah, you're going to make a bit of a pain in the neck of yourself, and it might take a while for your doctor to get used to your style. But if your doctor can't communicate with you, then you need probably move on to somebody who you can communicate with. I don't mean you should be trying to tell the doctor what to do, but you need to tell the doctor what you understand of what they want you to do and what you can see yourself following through with.
Yeah, that's such good advice and really important. And all of us are most likely to become patients at some time or another. So we all have to really educate ourselves and plan ahead for that day when we are in the patient's chair and trying to get our needs met. So I'll remind everyone, I'm talking with Dr. Drew Remignanti about his book, The Healing Connection, A Partnership for Your Health, which is a great read. And it's also filled with really interesting stories from the emergency room. Some are a little bit harrowing, but it's just loaded with studies and research and documentation for all of the points that you make in the book. So, Drew, I want to thank you so much. Thanks for writing the book. I'm so glad that you did, and that you, even though Compassionomics came out, that you went ahead and wrote your book. And I want to thank you so much for joining me to talk about it today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Karen. And please, I'd remind people, as you said, if you go to my Facebook page, I'll usually have an update there on where things are at in terms of the book, how to pre-order it now. And here's my salesmanship pitch. If you pre-order my book now, you get a 20% price reduction on the total cost of the book, plus the ebook version of my book gets thrown in for free, which you really want to have alongside you on some kind of an e-reader for all the hypertext linked references. And then the publisher threw in a second free ebook if you buy now. It's not that you can't get it later from Amazon or bookstores. You will be able to, but it won't be at the 20% discount. And I'm sure they'll charge you for both the paper book and the ebook.
And as you said, it's good to have the ebook version because you can just click on those links and go directly to the studies that you're referencing in order to read it for yourself. And that's really helpful. Well, thanks again, Drew. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thanks for having me on, Karen.
You're welcome. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Drew Remignanti. One of the things I wanted to emphasize again is the study that showed a mere 40 seconds of compassion was all that it took to have a significant difference on the health of individuals who received that compassion. And I think it's powerful for us to recognize that if we have this intention to show compassion toward others, to hold space, like the training that's coming up through the Institute for the Study of Birth, Breath, and Death, we can make a difference in the lives of other people. We can make a difference in their health and healing and well-being simply by being able to demonstrate compassion and to be with them with a heart of compassion. And the fact that it's been demonstrated in scientific studies makes it even more incredible and important for us to pay attention to. So if someone tells you, I'm too busy to have compassion for other people, remind them all it takes is 40 seconds of showing compassion to make a difference. No one is too busy to be compassionate. So this is something we all need to be striving for and working toward, to have an open heart that can carry compassion for other people. And I'm really grateful that Dr. Remignanti pointed that out in his book. The studies were mentioned in the book Compassionomics, which is another fantastic book that I recommend if you have a chance to take a look at. So if you enjoy content like this, please be sure to share it with other people who might also benefit from listening in. And if you haven't already, subscribe and leave a rating and review for the podcast wherever you happen to listen. That's really helpful in terms of rising up in the rankings so that this podcast will be shown to people who are searching for this kind of content. And if you'd like to make a small financial contribution to help keep this podcast on the air, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support. Finally, remember, I have a YouTube channel, End of Life University. If you like watching videos, you can see the video of this and other interviews posted there. I also have another podcast called What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality. If you're interested in talking more about these ideas of compassion, things that fall under the realm of spirituality, check out What Really Matters. So until next week, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next. And love each and every moment that you get to be here on this amazing planet. Bye-bye.